Blog Talk Radio.
Storyteller Evan Poss. I'm here with Daniel Michael here in the studio, Cafe Fairfax on the Main Street Universe Network. Hi, Daniel. How are you doing today?
Hello. I'm doing just fine.
Excellent. Now we got a great show for you guys lined up today. We're going to be discussing the oral folk traditions. So what in general? We'll talk a little bit about the folk traditions of India in particular, the nature of mythologies and folklore and storytelling, of course, that's our theme for the show. And we've got some good stories, some folk tales, some modern mythology, and so right now, to show off, Daniel is going to give you a little bit of a lowdown on what's new and what's happening on the Main Street Universe Network.
Yes, as you know, this is our second show that has been added to the network. The first one is, of course, our flagship show, which is Main Street Universe, more of our community, art, eclectic, talk about just about anything show. Then we have, of course, today, every Thursday at 11 a.m., Evan Pass is our host for Zariana Radio. Much discussion of myth and lore. And what role do we have to play in it, in a lot of comparative myth? And this will be a general theme of this show. As well, we have Walk on the Sidewalk. And that is with our co-host of Main Street Universe, Kevin Baird. In Journeys to the Horizon Oracle, our Oracle deck that he created, that he reads from. Also coming up two Sundays from now, we're going to have a swing day because we do use Sundays as sort of a special day for guests that maybe can't make it on another day. This is an author of a book that has been finished and it's out there on the market, and that book is Heart Healthy Pizza. It is vegan pizza, folks, no cheese. So I'm hoping he actually makes one of those when he comes over to visit Sunday. And any of our other hosts are welcome to show up that Sunday or call in. They're not obligated to, of course, but if they wish to, they can. So maybe if Evan's off, he can come over and maybe try some of his vegan pizza. I don't know what he uses instead of cheese, though, but we will see.
There's going to be vegan pizza. That's definitely some incentive.
Absolutely. I think he uses beans and grains and all sorts of different combinations to sort of replace the cheese factor. Another food that's really heavy, talking about diet, is that I love, like when I'm trying to cut back on meat and cheese and stuff like that, is avocados.
Yes.
They're just so thick and satisfying in that way. And I consider that to be, like, my joints, I think, feel better when I'm eating a lot of avocados. So I'd like to remind everybody that we are a three-show network now, and then we use Sunday as a swing day, a day to bring in a guest that maybe can't make it on another day. And this is a local guy. His name's Mark Sutton. Heart Healthy Pizza is the name of his book, and that's pizza without cheese, folks. Totally vegan pizza.
So we're going to get right on to the show here. And, of course, this might be in our second week. You know, I've been giving a lot of thought as to how we're going to go about the structure of the show. You know, what's going to be the content of this? How are we going to go about it? You know, what do I want to use this space for? And I mentioned a little bit last week that, and this goes along with, you know, Daniel's vision for the Main Street Universe Network as a whole and what he does with his show. I want there to be a sense of community here. And particularly, you know, the theme for the show is storytelling, mythology, and folklore. So, you know, any of you listeners out there have stories that are particularly meaningful, you know, mythologies that you've either written or, you know, from any source, you know, writers, ancient and modern, anything you want to share. That is what this show is all about. We're going to be taking stories from all ages, from all cultures, and, you know, kind of bringing them all together and discussing them, finding differences and finding similarities. What's some of the underlying archetypal themes that we see in stories from different ages and from different cultures? And I was actually just thinking this morning about, you know, what I was going to do for the show today. And I thought I had two different stories that I wanted to read today from two very different sources. And as I was thinking about these two stories, I realized that there is an undercurrent in both of them, that a similarity that really begs discussion. And we'll get to it later. I don't want to reveal too much right now. One of them is an Indian folktale, and another is from my favorite author, and I'm sure we'll be talking about him much more through the show and as the weeks go on. His name is Gene Wolfe. He's a modern science fantasy writer, still alive, although you know, up there in years. Fantastic writer. So we'll be doing, you know, a short story from each. And we'll see that there's a, you know, even if there's no surface-level connection, that there's something almost archetypal that underlies these stories. And so we'll be doing these stories today, and I have some other folk tales for you. But as the weeks go on, what I'm going to try to do is bring at least two, you know, sometimes three, sometimes more, the stories that share a certain theme, you know, and it sometimes it'll be more obvious, sometimes it'll be more subtle. But we're going to talk about them and see, you know, why that connection is there, what it means, you know, and what this has to do with us. And if, you know, we can continue that tradition, each of us is a storyteller, each of us is a myth maker. Each of us lives stories every day, and we have plenty of them. And you know, so let's flip those stories and bring them out and share them with the world. And on that note, I'd like to start with the first story of the day. And this isn't either of the two I just mentioned before. I have a few, and these are from a wonderful collection. This is called Folk Tales from India, a selection of oral tales from 22 languages. And this is put together by A.K. Ramanujan. And actually, Ramanujan is... You know, I didn't know this at first. I picked up this collection in a bookstore several years ago, the summer before I took my first class on Hinduism. And, you know, I really knew nothing about it and, you know, saw this book on the bookshelf and knew that I was going to be getting into studies of Hindu culture and mythology. I thought I'd give myself a little introduction. Little did I know, I picked up this book, read through the entire thing very quickly. These stories are fantastic. And I spoke to my professor, Steve Jenkins, the first day after class, and I was asking if he heard of it. And sure enough, he told me that A.K. Ramanujan was actually his professor. And he was the one who taught him spiritual tradition of Vinaya, the same class that he was now teaching me. You know, I thought that was an interesting synchronicity, and, you know, it's a fantastic collection. And it really highlights just there's stories, I think, that highlight the theme of storytelling, which is an interesting thing. There, you know, a lot of times there's stories about stories. And we get that a lot. And another thing that I want to touch on real quick before I get into this first one is the idea of the oral folk tradition, and, you know, we're talking about India here in particular, versus, say, the more Brahmanical tradition in India of, and this is a process of what's called Sanskritization, where folk deities and village gods and goddesses are subsumed under the Vedic gods and goddesses of the Brahmin culture. And, you know, it's quite a topic, and there's a lot to talk about. This has a lot to do with the caste system in India and how that plays out. But all throughout India, many of these village gods and goddesses, which have arisen, indigenous people in tribal village settings, have taken their, the gods and goddesses now become avatars or incarnations of, say, Vishnu or Shiva or the great goddess. And it's an interesting dynamic. It's a way for these gods and goddesses to stay alive and for the villages to keep their deities. And at the same time, sort of stay current with the temples. And, well, it's a big topic, and, you know, perhaps we'll get more into that later. But this first story we have here, it's called Tell It to the Walls, and this comes from the Tamil region of South India. And really, this will speak for itself, but it's a story about the importance of storytelling. And without further ado, Tell It to the Walls. A poor widow lived with her two sons and two daughters-in-law. All four of them scolded and ill-treated her all day. She had no one to whom she could turn and tell her woes. As she kept all her woes to herself, she grew fatter and fatter. Her sons and daughters-in-law now found that a matter of ridicule. They mocked her for growing fatter by the day and asked her to eat less. One day, when everyone in the house had gone out somewhere, she wandered away from home in sheer misery and found herself walking outside town. There she saw a deserted old house. It was in ruins and had no roof. She went in and suddenly felt lonelier and more miserable than ever before. She found she couldn't bear to keep her miseries to herself any longer. She had to tell someone. So she told all her tales of grievance against her first son to the wall in front of her. As she finished, the wall collapsed under the weight of her woes and crashed to the ground in a heap. Her body grew lighter as well. Then she turned to the second wall and told it all the grievances against her first son's wife. Down came that wall, and she grew lighter still. She brought down the third wall with her tales against her second son, and the remaining fourth wall, too, with her complaints against her second daughter-in-law. Standing in the ruins, with bricks and rubble all around her, she felt lighter in mood and lighter in body as well. She looked at herself and found she'd actually lost all the weight she had gained in her wretchedness, and she went home. So what can we say about this story? It's short and sweet, right to the point. You know, all of us carry these stories around with us all the time. Every person you see on the street, every person who you walk by, see every day, who you work with, who you go to school with, your family especially, we all carry around these stories every day. So many of them, literally, you can feel their weight. They're heavy. They're a burden within us. You know, this is something I've heard before, and, you know, I'm not sure who it was that said it or in what way or in what words, but in so many words, it's to the effect that you can never guess all the burdens that every person carries every day, so gracefully, without ever showing it. You know, we pass these people every day, we interact with them. You know, sometimes they brighten our day, sometimes, you know, they may annoy us or, you know, frustrate us. Whatever our interactions are with other people, for good or ill, we can never forget that, you know, every one of us is carrying around these burdens. We're not alone. No one's alone in this. You know, it feels like it a lot of times, right? Like the old woman, feeling lonelier and more miserable than ever. A lot of times we think that, you know, we're the only ones out there, and we have the weight of the world on our shoulders. And, you know, it really does feel like that when we're carrying around all this baggage within us. But it always helps to share what we have and to talk it out, you know. And that's what, it's a common thing, you know. You feel better after you speak your mind, right? And, you know, we feel better after you tell a good story, too. And a lot of times, you know, it's just the same thing. So, you know, to all my beautiful listeners out there, I can only say, share your stories, share your thoughts. You know, don't keep it all bundled up inside of you. So often there's the, you know, we feel perhaps a necessity to, as I've heard, suffer in silence. You know, but, you know, first of all, we don't really need to suffer at all, and we always feel better when we talk these things out. Feel lighter. You know, just let that burden go. Tell your stories. Share it. Share what you have to tell. What do you think about this story, Dan?
Well, I like what you mentioned about in the second part about what you're talking about being heard and being recognized, you know, like you're saying, the old person that doesn't have any, but of course we work in a grocery store and we definitely experience those old people that obviously no one hears or talks to.
Oh, yeah. So, you can tell that their stories haven't been heard. And
yeah, so that concept of being heard and being known is attached to our mortality, I think, or what our perception of mortality is, because it's like, nobody's hearing me. Nobody's. Where's my legacy? Where's my thing for folks to remember when I'm gone or moved on?
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, I think it's just something very simple and inherent about being a human being: the desire to communicate. You know. Whatever it is, you know, sometimes it's these are negative things and we bring walls down. And sometimes they're positive things, but I think it's very very important in this story that, you know, although she's you know, voicing her grievances against her sons and her daughters-in-law and the way they treat her, in the end, what's the result of that? She brings down the walls. You know, what do these walls represent? You know, she's in an old house. The old house probably needs to fall down anyways. No one's living in it.
Right.
You know, and it feels like, you know, those walls are what's separating her, you know, from, they're barriers, and, you know, there's things that need to be brought down. We all have our walls inside of us, and, you know, we get these things out, and, you know.
Again, it's, which is a theme so often in traditions that I like and respect, and that's the idea of movement and progress. And so something has to come down. And unfortunately, just like, say, the tower card, right? Sometimes something just has to be destroyed in order to move on and for the next thing to be built.
Absolutely. The tower card, very, very relevant here. Yeah, the for those listeners who are not familiar, though, tower, one of the trumps in the tarot, the picture is of somebody with a great tower being either struck by lightning or falling under the eye of God. And, you know, what does the falling of this tower mean for what comes next? You know, it's like the old structure that has to fall before the new structure can rise from the ground. You know, it creates the space. It's like Shiva in the Hindu pantheon, who we call the destroyer. But, you know, what is the nature of Shiva? He destroys so that there can be new life, new progress, new movement.
Mm-hmm.
Bring down old structures so we can, you know, build them new.
I'd like to take just a brief pause, but we're still actually staying on topic, basically. And that is just for a few upcoming announcements and suggestions. Natalie in the chat room, who I believe is someone that you know.
Someone very, very dear to my heart.
She mentioned for you to do a future show on Tantra.
Well, yes, that would be lovely. Thank you, Natalie, for the suggestion. And yeah, I think that's an excellent topic and one that we really will never be able to exhaust. So,
right. And as well, I'd like to mention that next week we're going to do a ritual for the solstice, and also as well, you were considering maybe doing your own form of a ritual for solstice.
Yes, and I want to tell my listeners, next week we're going to have a great show. It is the summer solstice next Thursday. And, you know, it's a little bit of a surprise, both for you, my listeners, and for myself, because I haven't planned it out yet. But we will have, a little bit of a ritual in our own way. It'll be a good show. We're going to be focusing on, as appropriate, solar mythologies, mythologies of the sun from different cultures. We'll be, you know, gathering some stories, different solar mythologies, different, archetypal associations. And again, that's an inexhaustible topic, so we'll have fun with that. And then I think to mirror that and follow it through, in the way that we should, the following week after that, and this is actually suggested topic by Natalie, and one that I love, is to do a show on lunar mythologies and stories and associations and archetypes of the moon. And that's a fun topic, too, because, and actually both with the sun and moon, with more modern mythologies, we have this whole phenomena of writing stories with worlds that have perhaps multiple moons and, sometimes multiple suns. Twin star systems, and, you know, everything that we know about the universe now that we never knew before. You know, every star out there is another sun. And what has that influx of information and what has that done for our imagination? You know, where have our stories gone from there? And I think just, you know, within the last 100 years, within the last 50 years, so many great science fiction fantasy writers who I understand to be, you know, in a lot of ways are modern myth makers, have taken these ideas and absolutely run with them. And we've come up with fantastic things. And how fun it is to imagine pantheons and mythologies and stories and astrological systems, what that would be like in a world where human beings are traveling between the stars, where human beings are inhabiting worlds with multiple moons and perhaps even multiple suns.
How would they affect the people being made up of, you know, 85% liquid, having all these different heavenly bodies pulling at them?
Absolutely, yeah. You know, it's something to consider that all of the mythologies of humankind on this planet throughout history have been in relation to this archetypal model of a sun and a moon. You know, each singular, each, you know, the same sun rising and falling every day for untold thousands and millions of years from the dawn of time and continuing to. And the same moon and the same stars. What will that be like when we're traveling between the stars and we lose that focus point? You know, what will it be like under a different sun and a different moon? You know, how will we understand these heavenly bodies? You know, I think there might be, you know, perhaps it's tempting to say that by the time we're traveling between the stars, we'll be so scientific-minded and, you know, above and beyond mythology that we'll just be able to, you know, accept them for what they are and not give it any more thought than that. But, you know, I don't really think that's the case. And this goes back to the theme of our show. You know, whatever these heavenly bodies are and whatever these archetypes are that are, you know, within the human being, there's always going to be the innate desire to tell stories about them. You know, and it doesn't have to be any more complicated than that. You know, but human beings like to put a human face on the world that we live in. And I'm not sure that instinct is ever going to be extinguished, no matter how far we go into the future. And perhaps, you know, it's gonna be more rekindled than ever as we move into these, you know, these new realms of space and time, where the loss of association with everything that we're familiar with just makes that drive, you know, so much more powerful and so much more necessary within us. Because, you know, they always say, we hear a lot of times with classic interpretations of what myth was to early people, that there's stories to explain universe that we don't understand. And now we feel like, all right, we're starting to understand the universe, so we don't need the myths anymore. You know, science is explaining everything, so what, you know, what role do myths play? But now we're you know, we're even gaining some, we're being able to step back from that and look at it. And, you know, the more science tells us about the universe, the more we realize just how little we know and how ultimately unknown it is to us. And that's just, for me, this is just going to bring a renaissance, a whole new wave of stories and mythology, you know, for a new world and a new understanding that we're coming into.
And I was going to hit on that, and you kind of rolled on it a little bit. And I was going to hit on that with the knowing can come lots of unknowing. And so what can happen is as you learn something, like say if you just learn about the microscopic world, well, now all of a sudden you see all these little particles and you don't know what they are. So what do? You start making theories, myths, and stories about all these things that you don't know exactly what they are. So a knowing can become an unknowing, almost I don't want to get too confusing here, but I was about to say almost a reverse triple Taoism, but I was just kind of joking. But I just meant...
Wow, it's inverted in so many ways.
It does, because, that's just how things can complement each other, or you could go back to something we say all the time here, is as within, so without, as above, so below, as the universe, so the soul. There's the microcosm and the macrocosm, and they just constantly grow and affect each other, and within relationship to each other.
And that relationship, which we call the mesocosm, that's where the story comes into play. That's where the ritual, that's where the ceremony, that's where the practice, where the mythology, you know, that's how we sustain and create and nourish that relationship between ourselves and the universe, you know. And between the universes within us that make us up as, you know, individual microcosms, and ourselves, the human macrocosm, the universe each unto ourselves. Mm-hmm. And, you know, when you start getting down to all those little particles, you know, we have molecules, and, you know, you start looking at the molecules and what those are composed of, and we find atoms, and then what those are composed of, and we find subatomic particles, electrons, and we start trying to, what's the essential nature of those? And
you get down the quarks and all of that. You start getting the quarks and light bands and everything else.
Absolutely, and, you know, and when we move that, take that attention outward, you know, we find ourselves in a solar system. A whole series of planets revolving around a star. And moons revolving around those planets. And we have galaxies that revolve around its center. And so, you know, within this universe that we can find no limits to, continuously expanding. And beyond that, well, maybe we'll know one day, maybe we won't. But, you know, therein lies the mystery.
And I like how you mentioned, I said microcosm, macrocosm, and you said mesocosm. I like that. That's the place where we're involved. Yeah, that's the place where I guess our higher self or subconscious or even conscious mind, that's where we step in. And then in accordance to however well-trained we are and whatever our tradition is, that's where our part as either participator or creator comes in, I guess. So I like that.
Absolutely. That's... you know, it's the interaction between the microcosm and the macrocosm. It's how one reconciles with the other and how we stay in communication. You know, and that's so important for the microcosms to maintain that direct communication with the macrocosm that we all help create. And, you know, so many different manifestations of religion and spirituality throughout time, you know, can be understood as different forms of mesocosm.
Exactly. So, did you have another story here?
Oh, yeah. So, I've got another story, and from the same collection, Folk Tales from India by A.K. Ramanujan. And this one also is very, very similar themes here. A story about storytelling. And this one's particularly fun. It's very whimsical in that way. And this one's called Untold Stories. And I think what this is essentially about, you know, is I don't suggest untold stories, is the importance of telling your stories and perhaps the consequences, which we don't often think about, of not telling your stories. You know, storytellers, everyone, you know, they may be wandering personalities. They may have nothing else to their name. You know, sometimes mysterious figures who, you know, travel from village to village with their tales, or perhaps with their instruments, their poetry, whatever it is. You know, perhaps with nothing else to their name but the clothes on their back and a stringed instrument or a drum. Carry priceless jewels within themselves, in the form of stories. You know, these stories, that's the wealth, and that's the human inheritance. It's what's, you know, the stories we tell ourselves are what brought us from out of the trees and out to the stars, telling ourselves stories all along the way. And it's I never like getting into making claims of universalism, but perhaps, you know, the story is one universal aspect of human life. We all tell them it's inescapable. The story takes many different forms. You know, now it's much more common. We have movies and you know, radio shows like this. It's the stories have jumped into technological mediums. But it's always there. And when we have these stories, the worst crime that you can commit is not to share them. You know, and this is why I'm really excited to have this show, because, you know, I spent a lot of my time reading stories and collecting stories. You know, I have a great passion for books. And there's so many of them at my fingertips, and, you know, well, what are they doing sitting in boxes or on a bookshelf? Like, let's get them out there. Let's share our stories. We all have so many of them. So, this one, as I said, is called Untold Stories. A gaunt peasant kept a farmhand who worked for him in the fields. One day they went together to a distant village to visit the gaunt son and wife. On the way, they stopped at a little hut by the roadside. After they'd eaten their supper, the farmhand said, "Tell me a story. Tell me a story." But the gond was too tired and went to sleep. His servant lay awake. He knew that his master had four stories, which he was too lazy to tell. When the gond was fast asleep, the stories came out of his belly, sat upon his body, and began to talk to each other. They were angry. "This gond," they said, "knows us very well from childhood, but he will never tell anybody about us. Why should we go on living uselessly in his belly? Let's kill him and go to live with someone else." The farmhand pretended to be asleep, but he listened carefully to everything they said. The first story said, "When the gond reaches his son's house and sits down to eat his supper, I will turn his first mouthful of food into sharp needles, and when he swallows them, they will kill him." And the second story said, "If he escapes that, I'll become a great tree by the roadside. I'll fall on him as he passes by and kill him in that way." And the third story said, "If that doesn't work, I will become a snake and run up his leg and bite him." And the fourth story said, "And if that doesn't work, I'll bring a great wave of water as he is crossing the river and so wash him away." The next morning, the gond and his servant reached his son's house. His son and daughter-in-law welcomed him and prepared his food and set it before him. But as the gond raised his first mouthful to his lips, his servant knocked it out of his hand, saying, "There's an insect in your food." When they looked, they saw that all the rice had turned into needles. The next day, the gond and his servant set out on their journey back home. There was a great tree leaning across the road, and a servant said, "Let's run past that tree." As they ran past it, the tree fell with a mighty crash, and they just escaped. A little later, they saw a snake by the road, and the servant quickly killed it with a stick. After that, they came to a river, and as they were crossing, a great wave came rushing down, but the servant dragged the gond to safety. They sat down on the bank to rest, and the gond said, "You have saved my life four times. You know something I don't. How do you know what was going to happen? And the farmhand said, if I tell you, I will turn into stone. The Gaunt said, don't be ridiculous. How can a man turn into stone? Come on, tell me. So the servant said, very well, I'll tell you. But when I turn into stone, take your daughter-in-law's child and throw it against me, and I'll become a man again. So the servant told his story, and so was turned into stone. But the Gaunt left him there and went home. After some time, his daughter-in-law heard about it, and she went all by herself and threw her child against the stone, and the servant came to life again. But the Gaunt refused to have him in his home and dismissed him. And that's why few people in this region trust a Gaunt. They even have a saying, no one can rely on a Gaunt, a woman, or a dream. Well, interesting lesson at the end of that, you know. it's kind of funny how, you know, we get these, sometimes these folk traditions are, they're beautiful, but they certainly have their prejudices.
Right, they bring some of the old school.
It's a great way to wrap it up, which is to say nothing of the story. Well, there's certainly something to be said about not trusting your dreams, you know, as people will attest to. But, so this one was called Untold Stories. And look what happens to this Gaunt fellow. Well, in fact, nothing really happens, you know, because of the loyalty, you know, of his servant. Really just wanted to hear his story. You know, if you don't tell your stories, look what happens. It's no way to live your life. He had perfectly good stories to tell, and he wouldn't tell them.
Mm-hmm.
There's something to be said for that. And what happens? Stories come out and conspire to kill him. You know, we don't often think about it that way. You know, that the stories within us have a life of their own. You know, it's an interesting concept to think about. You know, what is the nature of these stories exactly? Are they just a string of words and nothing else that we have inside of us? Well, you know, some would say that every story does have a life of its own, a personality, and a desire to be told, you know, to propagate itself. You know, stories in that sense, they're life forms just like we are. And, you know, their procreation is in the telling. Not in the sitting in your belly and not being told. And who gets any benefit out of that? Not us, not the humans who enjoy good stories, not the stories themselves who have a desire to be told.
Because, and I think in that living desire is because they represent, I think of it almost like a tarot card deck, and they represent aspects of ourselves that are real. Just like if you have different deity pantheons, each one represents a real force in the universe or an aspect of ourselves that is real. So, you know, all of us have an aspect of, you know, the elements or of a suit. And that's how I view, like, these stories wanted to express themselves because they do represent something real within us. So within our mini-universe and within the vast universe. So they are alive, and that was the part that probably grabbed my attention the most, was the part that they escaped from him to conspire how to kill him.
Right. First, you know, you just have the servants, you know, they're sitting there in their house passing the night in a house, you know, by the roadside. The servant wants to hear a story, and, you know, his fellow is just too lazy and, you know, doesn't have the, he's no motivation, or I don't know what it is, doesn't appreciate the stories that he has from childhood, and so he just doesn't tell him. But it doesn't just stay at that. All of a sudden, the stories, you know, come out of his mouth from his belly and are sitting there, you know, conspiring on, you know, how they can find someone who's going to actually tell them.
And it almost goes back a little bit to part of the first one you mentioned of the idea of wanting to be heard and wanting to be expressed, you know, and having expression. Expression is so important. I mean, that's why you know, that's what motivates writers and songwriters and everything else is expression in the creative process. And when you're not getting that and you're at, you know, the register,
as we can both attest to,
or whatever you're at,
whatever your station in life,
then you start to feel the weight of that, or you start to feel, I'm using the word weight, but it could be however it's expressed, you can start to feel that thing that comes over you when you realize that you're not being yourself. Like for me personally, I took about a 10-year break from being myself, and I kind of wasn't doing music anymore and other creative projects, and just was thought I was giving in to the world. I'm an electrician as well, and I was doing electrical work. Nothing wrong with that. I actually don't mind doing electrical work. My point was, though, is that I was just being a construction worker, and I wasn't being my artistic self like I am now. Now I'm working on all these different gazillion different projects, but that's all labor of love, and hopefully to be for a living. And when you step away from yourself, that is what it felt like. It felt like it came charging out of my gut, and then all of a sudden, I didn't have a guitar, I didn't have a recorder, but all these songs were like falling out of me. And I remember I was in a Walmart, and I bought like a $90 guitar from Walmart and a little amp, and I went home. A friend of mine, like the next day, I talked to a friend of mine, because it's funny how things come in. It was an old 4-track cassette recorder, and this wasn't that long ago, so you know that's a really outdated thing to record on. But it was just something. I just wanted something to record on. And he sold that and some microphones and a bunch of cords to me all for like $20. So I had something to record on and like a $100 guitar, and I wrote this entire play, you know, or all the songs for it anyway, not actually wrote the whole play, but I had like this idea for a musical play, and it all just like fell out of me within a couple months. It just was like, blah, like I just regurgitated this thing.
Yeah,
I had never had such a renaissance of so much artistic activity than at that time. I remember I converted my kitchen into a studio. I just had like, I mean, not a real like great sounding studio, but something to record on. And I had keyboard on the counter, and I just had these cassette tape players that I bought at the pawn shop. It was all old school technology. I didn't even have a computer then. This is only a few years back.
Dude, that's awesome. You know, and it's just like, it's something to say, if we're not going to tell the story or the song within us willingly, the song will conspire to tell itself. You know, it'll find a way. And, you know, in a lot of ways, we're just mediums for conveying the story, for singing the song, telling the tale. You know, and a lot of times we ourselves are the instruments being played by forces we can't even comprehend. The stories are much more ancient than the tellers. All right. Now, I think right now we're going to move on to the two main stories. And I really wanted, you know, those were both somewhat short, and I wanted to tell those first, you know, this is only the second week, as an introduction to everything that's going to be coming on later in the show and in upcoming weeks, you know, just to highlight the importance of the story and how the stories want to be told, and, you know, what the theme is here, what we're doing, what our goal is. So now we're going to get to the segment where I have two stories here, and there's parallels between them. One of them is also from this collection, you know, ancient folktale from India. And another is a modern folktale by contemporary science fantasy writer Dean Wolf. And we're just going to see how, you know, whether or not we're thinking about these things consciously, or, you know, whether there's however it happens, there's threads or strands of the story that are continuing throughout time. And, you know, they just pick up and they get told in different ways, and the stories continuously reinvent themselves, but there's threads that go all the way back. We could trace it through, you know, stories thousands of years old and, you know, 10 years old. So this first story from this same collection I've been reading from, Folk Tales from India, is called Other Lives. This is from the Kashmir region, northern India, on the border of Pakistan. For many years, a Brahmin practiced austerities and worshipped... Sorry, let me start that over. For many years, a Brahmin practiced austerities and offered worship to the gods in order to learn something of what happens to us when we die. At last, the gods favored him. One morning, as he was bathing in the river, his spirit left him and went into the body of an untouchable cobbler's child. The child grew up, learned his father's business, married, and became the father of a big family. Then, suddenly, he became aware that he was truly a Brahmin, and so he abandoned everything and went to another country. Now, just as he reached that country, the king died without an heir. So the ministers and elders resorted to the popular custom of sending an elephant and a hawk around the country to elect a successor. The people would accept as king anyone that the elephant and the hawk acknowledged. Well, wonder of wonders, the stranger, the Brahmin in the body of a cobbler, was chosen for the royal office. The elephant bowed before him, and the hawk perched on his hands, and thus proclaimed him king in the presence of all the people. A few years later, the cobbler's untouchable wife came to know of his whereabouts and went to join him. Then people began to gossip and ask questions, and it soon became known that the king was a cobbler, and that his wife was also lowborn. The people were outraged. Some rioted, some fled, some took to penance, and others burned themselves. Everyone was afraid of being excommunicated. The king, too, could not bear the shame and the chaos, and threw himself into a fire. At once, his spirit went and reoccupied the corpse of the Brahmin that still lay on the riverbank, and went home. When his wife saw him in the door, she said, "You're back already? How quickly you bathe and perform your morning prayers." The Brahmin said nothing. He only looked surprised and wondered, "Can this be what happens when one dies? Did all this really happen, or did I dream it?" Just about a week after this, a man came into the Brahmin's courtyard and begged for food. Saying he had eaten nothing for 5 days. He said he had been running away from his country as fast as he could, because a cobbler had become king and flew to the whole kingdom. All the people, he said, were running away or burning themselves to escape the evil that might befall them. The Brahmin gave the man some food, but said nothing. "How can this such things be?" he thought. "I've lived as a cobbler and raised my family for years, and then reigned as king for several more years. Just as I was convinced it was a dream, house and confirmed the truth of those happenings. Yet my wife says I've not been absent from the house for very long this morning. I believe her, for she does not look a day older, nor has the place changed in any way. Maybe the soul passes through various stages of existence, according to a man's thoughts and words and acts. And in the great hereafter time is measured differently. In that time, A day is equal to an eon, and an eon is equal to a day. Maybe. So what do we think about this story? It has this dreamlike quality to it, of course. Almost an unreality. You know, that the Brahmin is blessed, favoring the gods, by offering austerities to the gods, and is favored by them with this vision. And, you know, this vision takes him completely out of his body, and he lives an entire lifetime other than in a body other than his own. Becomes king, is born as an untouchable, ultimately returns to that. And suddenly finds himself back in the body that he had once occupied. And if that illusion isn't enough, he then finds out that, in a sense, everything that he had lived out had actually happened. You know, space and time are expanded and contracted in such a way that, you know, all we can say is maybe. You know, it's something about the ephemeral nature of life and how fleeting it is and how precious. And, you know, the value of these experiences.
I wanted to mention the aspects of it. First of all, of course, it being of the nature it is, there's always the caste system element going on.
Absolutely.
I would like to say hi to everybody here. We got a few listeners here in the chat room and a few on the phone lines. And mentioning, oh no, my king was a cobbler. How could I live in such shame? I know that's not really the point of the story, but it's interesting to see those aspects of the story.
I mean, it's a definitely cultural aspect, but you know, I'm not sure that, you know, there's something there. I think it is very much an important aspect of the story. And you know, I think it's important to keep in mind that this story isn't being told by Brahmins. This is being told, you know, by villagers. This is very much like an untouchable story. And we get this, you know, kind of inversion, like it's very much a story from that position, from the position of the outcasts and the tribals.
Right.
Who are so disempowered in, you know, in the Hindu caste system. You know, What does it tell us? It tells us that, you know, the life of a king and the life of an outcast, what's the difference between them?
It can be the same, because the part where he says, according to death being according to one's thoughts, you know.
Thoughts and actions, yeah.
Is that what is this, he was sort of saying in the story? What is this place? Someone has come and confirmed this thing has happened, and I've returned, and yet my wife still doesn't look any older, as he had mentioned. So a sort of transient, I guess if the word is correct, view of death and how it, our afterlife can be according to our thoughts and actions. And so I thought that aspect of the story was interesting.
Yeah, absolutely. And there is very much that sense of, you know, the underlying social commentary here. You know, it is very important that, you know, He goes from one of the highest stations to one of the lowest stations, to one of the highest stations, to one of the lowest stations, and back again. And what is the continuity there? You know, he always feels like he's himself, but what is that, you know, what is that essentially? What is he? What is the essence, that consciousness that goes from body to body, from life to life? You know, from this dream to another and back again. You know, that consciousness that dwells in a king. And, you know, he wasn't arbitrarily chosen to be a king. You know, it was almost by, you know, a divine intervention you know, that the elephant and the hawk recognized him, untouchable though he may be, as the king. And so, you know, how much does it have to do with the bodies that we're born into or the caste that, you know, that we live in? As much as it has to do with the consciousness, you know, that isn't born when the body's born and doesn't die when the body dies and passes from one life to another seamlessly. And, you know, this is very much a folktale from the lowest caste. You know, this isn't the sort of, you know, high and lofty Puranic or, you know, Upanishadic tales that the Brahmins are telling and writing of. This is something that's probably being told in the villages.
Mm-hmm.
Anything else on that, Dan? Or?
I think I said what grabbed me from that and the idea of our death. Is our afterlife, more accurately, is the result of our thoughts and actions, which
right.
plays into a lot of, you know, conversation we could have beyond that, and you could start talking about karma and everything else and learning lessons and things, or even something even transient beyond that. But, yeah, the idea of the afterlife being a result of your thoughts and actions of this life.
Right. And do you say we have people on the phone lines?
Listening.
Listening.
Like not calling.
Okay.
There's two different ways they light up for if you have a listener. Yes, Natalie, transmigration is... and we mentioned transmigration on our Main Street Universe show because we were talking about Pythagoras came up, you know, the philosopher Pythagoras.
Mm-hmm.
And he was big into transmigration and claimed to remember... vividly remember his followers said like four lies that he vividly claimed to remember in some detail. The great mathematician and philosopher.
That's fascinating. I didn't know that about him.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it wasn't just that little equation you learned in school. There was a lot more. He was kind of a mystic, but he believed that mysticism and math were kind of hand in hand, and that they weren't something separate. And that math and science, that mysticism and science, were not necessarily separate things. So he was huge into transmigration.
Oh, very interesting. Well, and I just want to encourage all our listeners out there to, you know, at any point, if you have stories of your own or, you know, anything that you'd like to share or talk about, you know, feel free to call in. And I'm really, really glad to see people using the message boards. And that's excellent. I'm just glad that we...
And that'll grow. We'll get more as the show is on the air longer.
Mm-hmm. Right. All right, so I'd now like to move on to our second story. So this is a piece of modern mythology, you could say, modern myth-making, by my personal favorite, Gene Wolfe. It's from a collection of short stories of his called Endangered Species. Always came out sometime in the late 80s, perhaps. Let's see. 1989. And the story we have here is called The God and His Man. Thank you, Dan. This is from 1980. Once, long, long ago, when the universe was old, the mighty and powerful god Isid Iu-Iu-E, whose name is given by certain others in other ways, and who is determined in every place and time to do what is good, came to the world of Zed. As every man knows, such gods travel on craft that can never be wrecked. And indeed, how could they be wrecked when the gods are ever awake and hold the tiller? He came, I say, to the world of Zed, but he landed not and made no port. For it is not fit, as those who made the gods long ago ruled, that a god should set foot upon any world, however blue, however fair. Therefore, Isid Ewe, remained above the heavens, and his craft, though it traveled faster than the wind, contrived to do so in such a way that it stood suspended, as the many hued stars themselves do not. Above that Isle of Zed, that is called by the men of Zed, for they are men, or nearly, land. Then the god looked down upon Zed, and seeing the men of Zed were men, and the women thereof women, he summoned to him a certain man of earth. The summons of Isid Ewe cannot be disobeyed. Man, said the god, go down to the world of Zed, for behold, the men of Zed are even as you are, and their women are women. Then he let man see through his own eyes, and man saw the men of Zed, how they herded their cattle, and drove their plows, and beat the little drums of Zed. And he saw the women of Zed, and how many were fair to look upon, and how they lived in sorrow and idleness, or else in toil and weariness, even like the women of earth. He said to the god, if I'm ever to see my home again, and my own women, and my children again, I must do as you say. But if I go as I am, I shall not see any of those things ever again. For the men of Zed are men, you yourself have said it, and therefore crueler than any beast. It is that cruelty we must end, said the god, and in order that you may assist me with your reports, I have certain gifts for you. He gave man the enchanted cloak, Tarnung, by which none should see him when he did not wish to be seen. And he gave man the enchanted sword, Master, whose blade is as long as the wielder wishes it to be, though it weighs nothing, and against which not even stone can stand. No sooner had man tied Tarnung around his shoulders and picked Master up that the god vanished from his sight, and he found he rested in a grove of trees with scarlet flowers. The time of the gods is not as the time of men and women. Who can say how long man wandered across land on Zed? He wandered in the high, hot lands where men have few laws and many slaves. There he fought many fights, until he knew all the manner of fighting of the people of the high, hot lands, and grew ashamed of killing those men with Master, and took for himself the crooked sword of those lands, putting Master away. Then he drew to him 100 wild men, bandits, and slaves, who had slain their masters and fled, and murderers of many kinds. And he armed them after the manner of the high, hot lands, and mounted them on the yellow camels of those lands, that oft times crushed men with their necks, and led them in many wars. His face was like the faces of other men, and his sword like their swords. He stood no taller than they, and his shoulders were no broader. Yet because he was very cunning, and sometimes vanished from the camp, his followers venerated him. At last he grew rich, and built a citadel in the fastness of the mountains. It stood upon a cliff, and was rimmed with mighty walls. 1,000 spears and 1,000 spells guarded it. Within were white domes and white towers, 100 fountains and gardens that leaped up the mountain in roses, and ran down it like children in the laughter of many waters. There man sat at his ease and exchanged tales with his captains of their many wars. There he listened to the feet of his dancers as the pattering of rain and meditated on their round limbs and smiling faces. At last he grew tired of these things and wrapped himself in Tarnung and vanished, and he was seen in the citadel no more. Then he wandered in the steaming land, grow taller. The men are shy, filled from the shadows with little poison arrows no longer in their forearms. There, for a long time, he wore the cloak Tarnung, always, for no sword avails such an arrow in the neck. The weight of the sword he had fetched from the high, hot lands oppressed him there. The breath of the steaming lands rusted its blade, so he cast it, one day, into a slow river where the black crocodiles swam, and the river horses with amber eyes floated like logs or bellowed like thunder. But the magic sword master he kept. In the steaming lands he learned the ways of the great trees, which each is an island, with its own dwellers thereon. And he learned the ways of the beasts of Zed, whose cleverness is so much less than the cleverness of man, and whose wisdom is so much more. There he tamed a panther with eyes like three emeralds, so that it followed him like a dog, and killed for him like a hawk. And when he came upon a village of the men of the steaming lands, he leaped from a high branch onto the head of their idol, and smote the hut of their chief with the sword master, and vanished from their sight. When he returned after a year to that village, he saw that the old idol was destroyed, and a new idol set up, with lightning in its hand and a panther at its feet. Then he entered that village, and blessed all the people, and made the lap of that idol his throne. He rode an elephant with a blood-red tusk and two trunks. His war canoes walked up and down the river on 100 legs. The heads of his drums were beaten with the white bones of chiefs. His wives were kept from the sun, so their pale beauty would lure him to his hut by night, and their fresh skin give him rest even in the steaming lands. And they were gorged with oils and meal until he lay upon them as upon pillows of silk. And so he would have remained, had not the god Isid Iui come down to him in a dream of the night and commanded him to bestir himself, wandering and observing in the cold lands. There he walked down 1,000 muddy roads and kissed cool lips in 100 rainy gardens. The people of the cold lands keep no slaves and have many laws, and their justice is the wonder of strangers. And so he found the bread of the cold lands hard and scant. And for a long time he cleaned boots for it, and for a long time dug ditches to drain their fields. And each day the ship of Isid Iui circled Zed. When it had made several hundred such circles, Zed circled its lonely sun, and circled again, and yet again, so that man's beard grew white, and the cunning that he had won in battles in the high, hot lands, and burned the idols in the steaming lands, was replaced with something better and less useful. One day, he plunged the blade of his shovel into the earth and turned his back to it. In a spiny, he drew out Master, which he had not drawn for so long that he feared its magic was no more than a dream he had when he was young, and cut a sapling. With that for a staff, he took to the roads again, and when its leaves withered, which they did but slowly in that wet, cold country, he cut another and another, so that he taught always beneath a green tree. In the marketplace, he told of honor, and how it is higher, and how it is a higher law than any law. At the crossroads, he talked of freedom, the freedom of the wind and clouds, freedom that loves all things and is without guilt. Beside city gates, he told stories of the forgotten cities that were, and of the forgotten cities that might be, if only men would forget them. Often, the people of the cold land sought to imprison him according to their laws, but he vanished from their sight. Often they mocked him, but he smiled at their mockery, which knew no law. Many among the youth of the cold lands heard him, and many feigned to follow his teachings, and a few did, and they lived strange lives. Then the night came when the first flakes of snow were falling. And on that night, the god Isid Iui drew him up as a puppeteer in his doll. A few friends were in the lee of the woods with him, and it seemed to them that there came a sudden flurry of snow spangled with colors, and man was gone. But it seemed to him, as he stood once more in the presence of the god Isid Iui, that he had waked from a long dream. His hands had their strength again, his beard was black, and his eyes regained their clarity, though not their cunning. "Now tell me," Isid Iui commanded him, "all that you have seen and done." And when man told him, he asked, "Which of these three people loved you best, and why did you love them?" Man thought for a time, drawing the cloak Tarnung about his shoulders, for it seemed to him cold in the belly of the ship of Isid Iui. "The people of the high, hot lands are unjust," he said, "yet I came to love them, for there is no falsity in them. They feast their friends and flay their foes, and trusting no one, never weep that they are betrayed. The people of the cold lands are just, and yet I came to love them also, though it was much harder. The people of the steaming lands are innocent of justice and injustice alike. They follow their hearts, and while I dwelt among them, I followed mine, and loved them best of all." "You yet have much to learn, man," said the god Isid Iui, "for the people of the cold lands are much the nearer to me. Do you not understand that in time the steaming lands and all the land of Zed must fall to one of its great people or the other?" Then while man watched through his eyes, certain good men in the cold lands died, which men called lightning. Certain evil men died also, and men spoke of disease. Dreams came to women and fancies to children. Rain and wind and sun were no longer what they had been. And when the children were grown, the people of the cold lands went down into the steaming lands and built houses there. And taking no slaves, drove the people of the steaming lands behind certain fences and walls, where they sat in dust until they died. "In the high, hot lands," commented man, "the people of the steaming lands would have suffered much. Many of them I had toiling under the whip to build my walls. Yet they sang when they could, and ran when they could, and stole my food when they could not. And some of them grew fat on it." And the god Isid Iui answered, "It is better that a man should die than that he should be a slave." "Even so," man replied, "you yourself have said it." And drawing master, he smote the god, and Isid Iui perished in smoke and blue fire. Whether man perished also, who could say? It is long since man was seen in the land of Zed. But then he was ever wont to vanish when the mood took him. Of the lost citadel in the mountains, overgrown with roses, who shall say who guards it? Of the little poisoned arrows, slaying in the twilight, who shall say who sends them? Of the rain-washed roads, wandering among forgotten towns, who shall say who tracks they are? But it may be that all these things are now past. For they are things of long ago, and the universe was old, and there were more gods. So what do we think of this story, the god and his man? I think there's quite a bit there in a rather short story.
Yeah. Excuse me. There did seem to be a lot in that frame. And there seemed to be the idea of necessity of each other.
So,
sorry, sort of, I know I was getting a little bit of an interdependency of the God and the men and the Zed.
Right. It's definitely, you know, there, it has that, that modern mythic quality to it. You know, we have gods traveling in spaceships to other stars, you know, to worlds around other stars.
And that they're not these sort of perfect, all-knowing, all-seeing gods, almost like they're just slightly more advanced beings, and he was able to kill them with the sword in the end.
Right. So, so the in the end, the god's trying to make his point. He says, it is better that a man should die than that he should be a slave. And then man replies, even so, you yourself have said it.
Yeah, so he turns it on him and says, well, you know, I'm kind of done serving you at this point. That's how he do that, you know.
And, you know, look what happens. He spends time with these three different lands with three very different cultures and societies. And, you know, it's almost like this god is putting him to a test. But I think we can say right off the bat that this god that we have, Isid Iu Iwi, is by no means a supreme god. You know, he's a demiurge. He's, for one, he was something that, you know, we see from the beginning was created by man. You know, it says that all the gods are created by man. Which isn't to say that that which is behind the gods was created. Perhaps we just create the masks that the gods work through. And this, you know, is one of those masks, one of those forms that God takes, but ultimately a demiurge. You know, and there's this power struggle here. Because this god Isid Iu Iwi has, you know, there's an agenda. He, the people of the high hot lands, instead of, what is it, very few laws, you know, more of just like a cutthroat society where, you know, you have to survive by your wits and, what's it say here? They have no falsity to them. They feast their friends and slay their foes, and trusting no one, never weep that they are betrayed. And it's harder for him to love the people of the cold lands, which has have many laws, and have a strange justice to them. You know? But it's the people of the hot, steaming lands, you know, like the rainforest. And he says, they are the one who follow their hearts. And when he was with them, he learned to follow his heart too. And ultimately, this god tells him that his judgment there was incorrect. And man sees through his eye as these people are imprisoned, although they're not taken slaves. But what? They're put in, you know, concentration camps and extinguished. So that the men of the cold lands, with their many laws and their strange justice, you know, can move in and build their houses there. You know, it is definitely a strange justice, and there's a strange relevancy to the world, I think, that we live in today. And God tells him that, you know, these people of the cold lands, with their strange justice and their many laws, are his favorite. And that
is like them.
Nearest to him. Yeah. And so, if ultimately that's the god that is in power, and that's the god that people are worshiping, I think there's something to be said that, you know, if the mythology or the deity isn't suiting us, or it's not being interpreted in the right way, we're human beings. And in a lot of ways, that sword is like a pen. He slashes it and reinvents it. You know, we can, human beings are the ones who create the gods, we're the ones who write the scripts. We hold the pen in hand. or the paintbrush. We hold the instruments. We sing the songs. We tell the tales. And I think we're at a very interesting point in the world right now, where we're seeing, you know, firsthand what happens when we have stories that don't suit us, that don't benefit us as a species, as a world, as one world, as one people. You know, we're, you know, no number of laws, you know, no number of convoluted laws are really going to cut it. You know, and this strange justice, who is it serving? Who is it serving? So, on that note, we are nearing the end of our show, and Dan has his tarot cards out. We're going to do a reading. Dan, you want to tell us a little bit about what we're doing here?
I just thought we'd do a one-card reading on a concept. We talked about it a little bit at work. Do you have in your mind a concept to ask, or perhaps a general or societal question to ask?
Let's draw a card about the idea of myth-making, and about the idea that we write our own stories. Let's see what card comes up. You know, it's fun to ask, you know, these abstract questions and you know, see what the card tells, because, you know, what meaning do they have in themselves? But when we apply it to something, there's so much relevance. So what did we draw, Dan?
This one is the Ten of Pentacles.
Oh, wow.
Sorry, I don't have the Ten of Pentacles. And Ten of Pentacles means success based on our own efforts. It often means the material world, but I think you could also just say that this is the concept of, if we put it in the context of myth, being, okay, if we do it right and we work on it, it can be a very rewarding experience, and that myth can be our idea of being myth creator can be a very rewarding experience, the Ten of Pentacles being very beneficial. And notice he's sharing. There's a lot of sharing in this card.
There is.
And family. So there's also the idea of family, the human family, and sharing this entire thing. Now, we also said how it sort of with society, and it came out initially reversed. So to me, what that says is that if not done right, then, as you were saying, because you were commenting on this just before we put it, you know, how non-beneficial stories and non-beneficial myth and non-beneficial and non-productive things like we have in society today, like, say, some of these fearful police shows and all these things, that's what we'll get, is the Ten of Pentacles reversed.
So it's so relevant, and there's so much insight in this card. This is the final card in the tarot, and as it unfolds, that is the final of the 72 cards, the final unfolding, you know, like the final manifestation. It's the end point in creation, so to speak. Beautiful. There's just something about the cards that, you know, when you pose that question, whatever it is, it always has that such insight. You know, there's so much to be gained. I think that both Dan and I are a big grins on our face right now, just because, like, what a perfect card to draw.
Yeah, about
for that question.
And you can have either the ultimate reward, and you were talking about how there's negative stories, so we can also be ultimately not benefited by listening to the wrong stories, listening to the wrong myths. And you've been listening to Zariana Radio. We're coming down to it. Thank you, Evan, for being here again.
Of course, Dan, and thanks for joining me. And until next time, tell the tale, my friends. Tell the tale.
And remember that the mysteries and possibilities of the universe are closer to Main Street than you may have ever imagined.
Schneider, 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 Schneider